From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, she lost her infant daughter to whooping cough. Now a Michigan mom is leading a new campaign to raise our state's low vaccination rate.
When a parent is making a decision about whether or not to vaccinate a child, it doesn't just affect that child. It affects entire communities.
The story of Holocaust survivors who fled Europe in World War II to build a new life in Traverse City.
It was heartbreaking. You know, she left her family. She couldn't do anything. She had to get out. She had no choice.
And what happened to those they left behind? Plus, freed from the prison of OCD.
What happened was, since I let the OCD in the door, if you will, it became much less of a friend and more of a monster.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Baby Francesca was just 12 weeks old when she came down with a cough. 9 days later, she died of pertussis, of whooping cough. Her mother, Veronica McNally, has made it her life's work to hammer home the importance of vaccination. And she's part of a new campaign that's being launched today called I Vaccinate. Veronica McNally is with us now, along with Michigan's chief medical executive, Dr. Eden Wells. And a pleasure to welcome both of you to Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Wells, when you rank all 50 states based on immunization coverage of preschoolers, here we have Michigan down in the basement at 43rd, with only 54% of preschoolers up to date on their vaccinations, and only 29% of Michigan teens are immunized. How did we get here?
You know, I think that that's an excellent question, and there's not an easy answer. I think there's a number of people who would like to say it's simply due to the role of people who are anti-vaccine, but I think it's more than that. We had a number of experts and stakeholders meet last year, actually, to sit down and really go through what may be the barriers, access to health care, difficulty. You know, children might get started on their vaccines, but they don't finish up their vaccine series. So it's probably a bit more complicated than just simply saying it's an anti-vaccine movement. And so there's been a lot of work now, such as what you're seeing being launched today, on trying to get a different way to improve the vaccination rates in the state, because they are very low here. We're 43rd in the United States.
Yes, indeed. And I know, Veronica, after you lost Francesca, you formed a foundation called Franny Strong, and you've been working to educate people about the dangers of not only of pertussis, but of not being vaccinated. So what do you hear when you talk to parents? I mean, what are some of the reasons that you hear from them that they don't get their children up to date on their vaccinations?
Well, they have concerns, and every good parent wants to protect their child, of course, and so those concerns are unfortunately the result of what we're seeing right now. About half of parents with toddlers are choosing to delay the vaccines or skip them altogether, and so we determined that we really need to address this issue. We need to address the conversation surrounding vaccines and get answers for the parents to their questions, and ivaccinate.org is where they're going to be able to find this information.
Yes, so let's talk about this being launched today, ivaccinate.org. What's it going to look like, and how will people know about it?
It is great. We have a multimedia campaign that you will see across the state. We'll have a great social media presence. This website is designed to answer people's questions, but really to hit home on two messages. And that is that consensus exists, that vaccines are safe and effective, and that it is the best thing a parent can do to protect their children from these vaccine-preventable diseases, which, frankly, can be fatal. And also that when a parent is making a decision about whether or not to vaccinate a child, it doesn't just affect that child. It affects entire communities. And it's really important that parents understand the significance of what we call herd immunity.
Dr. Wells, as a physician, it must be so frustrating to encounter parents who put more credence into something they turned up on an internet search than what you can tell them as a physician about vaccination and why it's important.
You know, it has been, and certainly I've worked with promoting vaccination for, you know, over two decades now, and I think what we've learned is that often it's not necessarily the message, but even where the message is coming from. And as you say, the internet is probably inadequate, but so may be the fact that, you know, sometimes there are those out there that don't want to believe perhaps the government agency that always says, you know, yes, vaccination is good for you, just like covering your nose when you sneeze. And yet what is so powerful powerful. This is a public-private relationship that built this iVaccinate.org program. People like Veronica, you can tell she's so personally, you know, motivated and has been really the heroine of this whole project. It's really about parents talking to other parents. And I think that carries much more, it's a message much more powerful than anything that can come from myself. As much as I'd love to think people listen to me, I would rather think that I think sometimes talking to our peers that have been there and understand, you know, personally the concerns that moms and dads have are really key. So that's what's really exciting about this program today.
And Veronica, I know it's you've worked so hard to turn that loss of your baby into really this important teachable moment for other parents. Tell us a little bit, your daughter's symptoms at first, what were they like?
She began with an almost unnoticeable cough. I honestly don't know. If I hadn't been paying attention to it, I don't know that I would have realized that she was coughing. And the progression of the illness was rapid over the next few days. So the timeline was that when she began coughing, I called our pediatrician to see if she could be seen. And she was seen the next day, where the pediatrician indicated that she definitely caught something but wanted to wait to see if she got worse. So we didn't treat her at that time because we didn't know what she was presenting with. Mm. And that weekend, we took her to an emergency room where the physician thought that she was okay and sent us home. The next day was Mother's Day, and I spent all day trying to get her comfortable and realized that something was really, truly wrong. So we had a very rocky night. Immediately the next morning, I took her back to the pediatrician where they suspected that she did have pertussis. And we waited for a blood result confirmation that indicated that she had elevated white blood cell count. And so we took her into a pediatric intensive, well, to the emergency room, and they admitted us into the intensive care unit. She was intubated the following day, and on the 17th, she passed away. So it was just about a week after she began showing those symptoms.
That's stunning. And when you tell that story, it makes me stop and think, even as a parent who's, you know, been through this with my kids, with, you know, get the vaccinations, and you hear these names of diseases. But I wonder if we've all gotten blasé and overconfident, Dr. Wells, about the danger of these diseases. I mean, when Veronica tells us this story, we've got more people having their kids vaccinated on schedule. Those diseases kind of faded into the public awareness, didn't they?
They did. I think one of the concerns, as we were talking about pertussis or whooping cough, you know, what's really concerning is we're actually, just in this last year, in 2016, we had over 400 cases of pertussis diagnosed in the state. And so we're continuing to have a higher than expected activity of this particular disease, which normally, if the vaccinations are all being done and conducted and per scheduled, should not be occurring. And I think it does. We do get blasé, but it takes just one unfortunate, horrific event, and it makes people perhaps think a little bit more, but we don't want to see any more of these events.
In fact, I know Veronica used that term herd immunity, and I guess this is a real good time to kind of refresh everybody's memory and, you know, school us on what that means, and have we lost it in Michigan with such a poor immunization rate?
Well, this is Eden, and I think that that is a big concern for us, that we have found not only are there those parents who feel that vaccination should not be done with their children, but there are some that do start the vaccinations but then do not end up completing the series. So we actually have an incredible number of not only unvaccinated children, but children who are under-vaccinated. And when that happens is vaccine-preventable diseases just have a better chance of coming back, such as pertussis that I mentioned earlier. And when a sufficient number of persons are immunized due to a particular a disease, you know, that is called herd immunity. Sometimes we call it community immunity. And what's really important about that is that not everyone can be vaccinated. There are medical reasons, very rare, but they are there, for some children that cannot be vaccinated. Maybe they have an underlying cancer or leukemia or other reasons they can't receive these vaccinations. The only way that they will be protected is if the community around them are vaccinated and thus protecting or buffering that child. And so that herd immunity is very, very important, certainly for things like pertussis or whooping cough, but for other things, especially measles or mumps.
Veronica, I stop and I when I think of the fact that Francesca was just 12 weeks old, so she
You know, when you think that that diphtheria tetanus pertussis series is 5 doses, starting at 2 months old, so pertussis claimed her before she could even complete her series.
That's right. And unfortunately, I think that we don't understand that as parents. We take that for granted. And it's really important that parents understand the significance of these diseases, the fact that they are still occurring. It's not just pertussis. We have obviously the dramatic increase in cases in Michigan in pertussis, but last year we had a really large number of chickenpox cases, and primarily in schools and childcare settings. Mumps cases right now are at the highest number in a decade, and Arkansas is investigating a huge outbreak. So these diseases are real, and I think that parents, because we don't see them every day, I think that we take that for granted, and we really want to change that. iVaccinate will change this.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wells, what will people find if they go to iVaccinate.org?
What I consider that it's a wonderful website full of the many tools that a parent or an organization can use to help promote this program or to help educate people who may be concerned about vaccination and want to learn more before they vaccinate their children. And especially, as I said, the power comes from parents being empowered to take this information and share this information with their friends and their peers.
Veronica, how will you measure success of iVaccinate.org?
We have a really easy way to measure success in Michigan because we have the Michigan Care Improvement Registry, and that tracks our immunization rates. And we will see a rise in immunization rates, we think. And we know this because in the late 90s, we had terrible vaccination rates. And over a 6-year period of time, through a public education campaign called Immunize Your Little Michigander, we rose to 6th in the country in immunization rates. So these methods of public education opportunities and campaigns, they really do work. And we want this message to be empowering for parents. We want parents to feel free to ask questions and feel free to get the answers to those questions, because at the end of the day, that's what's going to make the difference.
Veronica McNally of the Franny Strong Foundation and Dr. Eden Wells, who is the Chief Medical Executive of Michigan. And once again, the website for iVaccinate, it's easy to remember, iVaccinate.org. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how do Michigan kids with disabilities find opportunities to play sports that are adapted to meet their needs? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea has put together an innovative way for these kids to learn and to play. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some call it the doubting disease. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. It's when you've got recurring and uncontrollable thoughts and behaviors. You get repeated thoughts or urges. They make you anxious. So you begin performing some action you hope will settle the anxiety. Maybe washing your hands or excessive cleaning. Maybe arranging and ordering things in a very particular, precise way. Kirsten Pugash of Howell started experiencing her OCD symptoms when she was just 9 years old. And after decades of wrestling with this disorder, she finally managed to free herself of what she calls the OCD prison. And Kirsten's written a memoir designed to help those who struggle with obsessive compulsive disorder called Leaving the OCD Circus. Kirsten, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
When you think about being 9, when symptoms began, what changed?
Well, what happened was I started to hear kind of an inner monologue or an authoritative voice that would give me certain instructions. And in the very beginning, because my childhood was unstable, having some order or tapping out to a certain number brought almost a sensation of control that I was able to do something and apply my energies that way. And what happened was, since I let the OCD in the door, if you will, it became much less of a friend and more of a monster.
And that monster, I know you called that monster Sergeant.
Yes. And the interesting thing about the book is that at the time that Sergeant or OCD came into my life, I had no name for it. And I only came up with the name Sergeant when I was writing the book, because it's so intangible and mercurial, I couldn't just say, and this thing. I needed to name it something. And that's why Sergeant seemed to make a lot of sense to me.
Beginning then as kind of a softer approach to helping you make
order out of what you say is a chaotic childhood. How did it evolve to this harder, harsher master you call Sergeant?
Well, what happened was more and more he would come into my daily life, my daily thoughts, and the challenges that would be set out before me became much more rigorous and much more frequently. For instance, I would say tap to the number 20, and if my index finger didn't feel quite right, then he would very quickly tell me it was imperfect and count over. So I'd do another 20. Maybe when I was done with 20, I'd have to do 100. Maybe after 100, I'd have to do 50. And this might have been while I was sitting there, you know, in third or fourth grade, listening to the teacher and silently having to do these tapping drills to satisfy Sergeant.
And then as you get older, you describe in your book, this really put you in a prison.
Absolutely. And a lot of people ask, why do I call my book Leaving the OCD Circus? And one is I definitely speak in metaphors. So prison is definitely a constraining place where OCD can keep you. And the title of the book is the word circus, and not the fun cotton candy good time circus as a kid, but the hellish, nightmarish circus. So whether you're in prison or in a hellish circus, if you can't find your way out and you don't know that there is a way out, then you're absolutely stuck.
What was rock bottom?
Rock bottom for me was I had undiagnosed OCD for 22 years. It was not nearly in the common vernacular like it is now. And I really didn't know what was going on with me, but I knew that I was ill. And I would go to the library and look up bipolar or manic depression and try to get my arms around what I was suffering with. And I had a complete mental breakdown collapse in the middle of a street, of all places, in Walnut Creek, California, when we lived there. And that's when I knew I could not exist with this parallel reality, that I really needed help. And it was much bigger than my husband or myself was able to manage.
And what was the moment of help? Under what guise did that help come?
Well, that is a great question. And I have a passion in my heart for NPR, and I always will, because, like I said, I did not know the letters OCD or what they stood for or anything. I was very much in the dark. And my husband, he's an artist. He was at home in his studio, and he heard a PSA from the International OCD Foundation that said, do you or someone that you know or love suffer from, and they went on to explain OCD. And he sat up and thought, oh my God, this is exactly what we're dealing with. And it was the real eureka moment. And luckily, it came very quickly after my collapse in Walnut Creek.
There is a saying that my husband brought with him from Ireland, that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Absolutely.
So putting a name on that, how did therapy help you?
Well, I was very lucky that through this PSA that there were numbers that I could call to get specialists in my area. And the wonderful gentleman who I'm still in contact with, Dr. Kalb in Northern California, was willing and able to see me that day. And that was really the first big step on the path of health and well-being.
Which you try to share as you write your memoir, you're also trying to help people who either are struggling with OCD or, like your husband, love someone who is. And I'm wondering what the do's and don'ts are for, especially for the family, for the friends. What would you tell your husband, knowing what you know now, when you think of those early years?
There's so many different ways I could answer that, but the first thing, speaking to the person with OCD, is that it's a real medical condition. So it's not just a preference of how you like to do things, and I think that very frequently gets very confused. It is not your fault, and it is a medical condition, and it truly is your brain misfiring. And so you really do have something that is medical. It's not made up.
How does someone know whether what they're doing is a habit, hair twirling or maybe skin picking or things like that, versus OCD? What's the border?
A lot of people say that they're on the spectrum after they read the book or what have you. They say, you know, I don't think I have OCD, but I have things that are kind of similar. Basically, what it means is you give up your existence to satisfy this authoritative voice in your head, and you do strange and odd things just to keep yourself going. For instance, someone might go back and check their door and say, oh, gee, did I lock the door? I want to be safe, so I'm going to go back and check it. Is that OCD? No, that's not OCD. That's just being, you know, responsible and wanting to, you know, keep track of your things and stay safe. What OCD looks like is that there's a lot of what ifs and doubts. For instance, I would have gone back and checked my door and thought, okay, it's locked, I can go on to school. Then maybe I'd get 30 seconds, you know, down the path, and OCD says, well, what if you didn't lock it? Because if you didn't lock it and you do such stupid, horrible things all the time, you could cause a death or something catastrophic to your family and your cats and those that you love. So you better go back and check it because you could be the cause of all these catastrophes. It'll be on your head, so do what you want. And then I'd go, okay, I need to go back and check. And then not check once, but check up to 100 times. There were times in high school I would go into class and I would be sitting there and OCD would be saying, what if you left it open? There could be a murderer that comes in and stabs your mom to death and it's going to be on you. So much that I can't function in daily life and I would have to go back home and recheck the door and very much getting caught in this loop. It's quite different and it's really quite a falling off the cliff when you have OCD as opposed to just having things that you would like a certain way.
And it's treatable.
It's treatable, and there are different things that you can learn. And one of the things, Cynthia, in my book is that, yes, it's a memoir. So the first half is kind of my story, letting you know what I was working with. I was very much a checker and a perfectionist. However, OCD rears its ugly head in so many different ways to different people at different times. And in the second part of the book, I really write a self-help book. And there's so many things that people can start doing right away so they can get onto their big happy life much faster than I got onto mine. Some people do very well with medication. Other people prefer not to use medication. There's also cognitive behavior therapy where you kind of retrain your thinking so your feeling is going to be different. And there's also just management of health and diet, getting enough sleep and doing things that don't exacerbate anxiety.
And clearly support people in your life can get a lot from this as well.
Absolutely.
Lots of information in this memoir and self-help book from Kirsten Pagosh of Howell. It's entitled Leaving the OCD Circus, and you can find more information by going to leavingtheocdcircus.com. Kirsten, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
Moments of play, of succeeding in some kind of athletic endeavor. Those childhood and school moments can last a lifetime. So how do children with disabilities get their chance to experience these very same special moments? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea took that question and she made it her life's work. Leah Ketchison got her PhD in kinesiology from the University of Michigan. These days, she is the executive director of Light Up. It's a group that develops research-based programs for adults and children who have special needs. And among them is an innovative program called Spectrum of Sports as they partner with Wayne State University. Leah Ketchison, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
Leah, tell us, first of all, what is the mission of Light Up and, in turn, Spectrum of Sports?
The mission of Light Up is to improve the quality of life of individuals with disabilities across the lifespan through programming in the physical and social domain.
So that's right to the point. And Spectrum of Sports looks at the youngsters, doesn't it?
That's right. So Spectrum of Sports, we really wanted to create a program which would provide youth with disabilities the fundamental motor skills that were related to future participation in physical activity and future social opportunities. So we've really targeted these key fundamental motor skills which have been linked to that behavior later on in life. And that's really Spectrum of Sports. We start with this intense fundamental motor skill acquisition, followed by an opportunity to practice these skills in team sports and in games.
And to do that, we get into the concept of adapted physical education and adapted sports, don't we? What are we talking about?
All quality physical education is actually adapted physical education. So what we're doing is tailoring the needs of the individual to be able to maximize their opportunity for successful participation in physical activity. So, for example, if a child is working on catching a ball, well, we might start with a larger ball that's a little bit easier to catch and a lighter ball that's easier to catch. And then we might sort of move down the spectrum of what we would be gradually more and more difficult to catch and or to throw. We really try to tailor the instruction to meet the individual needs of the child. And that's really the crux of adapted physical education and adapted sport.
And why does this matter physically and emotionally to children with disabilities?
There are key skills that are linked to future opportunities to engage in team sports and be social later on in development. We're trying to intervene at a time that's sensitive in development in order to change these trajectories throughout the course of a lifetime. In terms of the social domain, there is research to support the more opportunities that we can give children at a young age to acquire these skills, the more likely they are to have social opportunities later on in life.
Honestly, as you point out in your essay for The Next Idea, schools can only do so much, can't they?
Right, and schools are limited by what is state-mandated physical education. Many schools might have one or two opportunities per week lasting 25 to 35 minutes. We found, based on feedback from parents and what we're finding in our research, that's just not enough to make a significant change in the children's lives with disabilities. We have developed these specific programs that can supplement what they might be learning in school and make it continuous. Our goal is every time we launch a program at LightUp, we want to sustain this program.
And as you say, it's across the age spectrum. I'm interested in the partnership you've created with Wayne State University for Spectrum of Sports. So this is the idea is let's augment what youngsters might be getting through school or limited numbers of special programs. What does Spectrum of Sports consist of?
Spectrum of Sports is a fantastic program. As part of my affiliation with Wayne State as an adjunct faculty, we are supplementing the undergraduate and graduate student experience at Wayne State with a practicum component. They're enrolled in a class called Adapted Physical Activity, where they are required to participate in a number of contact hours with individuals with disabilities. These students are being trained week to week on how to best instruct children with disabilities. And I do that as the first part of the lecture. As the second part of the class, we move into the gym where these students work one-to-one in a ratio of one-to-one with undergraduate or graduate degree students, along with a child from the Detroit area, where they are going to receive, every single student receives direct individualized instruction in a one-to-one ratio.
How easily could this idea be spread out from Wayne State to across Michigan?
That's what we love about LightUp, because this methodology is really replicable across any environment that has the built environment like a gymnasium and access to either high school students or university students who want to work in this one-to-one ratio where we can teach the children the skills necessary to acquire the fundamental motor skills in a small ratio. This can be adopted across any community that has access to a large gymnasium and sort of limited equipment, and then access to eager volunteers and to parents who want to give their children this opportunity.
For your students at Wayne State who are working with these youngsters with disabilities, when you hear back from them, what have you heard? What surprises them about working with these children?
For many of the students in my classes, this is their first opportunity to work with a child with a disability. And it's amazing. I think that their reflection, it's that they're amazed at the capacity of every single child. It doesn't matter what type of disability it is, whether a single limb is affected or whether a child is nonverbal or they're limited in some other physical capacity. They are amazed that following this program, how much the child can actually do with this direct individualized instruction.
And underlying all of this is the fact that everything you do at LightUp is research-based.
Yes, we have partnered with the Sunfield Center, which is a behavioral health clinic here in Ann Arbor, and they are really our subject matter experts that are helping us to deliver only the most research-informed practices. So we're taking a lot of what's been published in the social and communication domains, most recently the motor domain, and we're implementing that into our program. So every single one of them has the most research-informed supported strategies implemented into these programs.
Well, you can certainly find out lots more about Light Up's programs, whether you want to see about getting a youngster involved in Spectrum of Sports or seeing what it might take to be able to bring this to your community by going to their website, lightupnow.org. That's lightupnow.org. And, of course, you'll find Leah's essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Leah Ketchison, great work and exciting prospects, I think, and it'll be fascinating to watch this spread through Michigan as more and more people learn about what you're doing at Light Up.
Thank you so much.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, the family that fled Nazi Austria to build a brand new life in Michigan, and what happened to the loved ones they left behind. The Holocaust comes to life in letters cherished by a Traverse City woman. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was some 75 years ago when the United States entered the war in Europe. This next story is about the dramatic impact that declaration had on a Jewish family from Austria during the Holocaust. Some of the family escaped and settled in Traverse City. Morgan Springer from Interlochen Public Radio has the story.
Lil Ostendorf sits in her home in Traverse City. In front of Lil is a copy of a letter written by her grandmother. It was written in 1943 when Lil was 3 years old.
All right. Are you going to preface this in any way, or do I just start? Do you want me to read this, the date, and everything, right?
Lil's grandmother wrote the letter in diary form. The letter begins in 1941 as she flees Austria to escape the Nazis during the Holocaust and follows her journey over the next 2 years.
Budapest, May 27th, 1943. My beloved dear children, my heart will not give up hope that we shall see each other again in happiness. However, in the event that cruel fate might not permit us to come to you, I am writing this all down as far as I can remember so that you at least might know everything from the time we were no longer able to write to you.
This story spans two continents and three generations.
I'm Robert Adler, or Bob. I don't have any preference.
My name is Lil. My last name is Ostendorf. My maiden name is Adler.
I'm the youngest of three.
Of course, I'm the smartest one. Just ask them.
Bob is visiting his sister Lil at home in the house where they both grew up. Lil raised three kids and has multiple grandkids.
I keep coming back to family, but it's the most important thing, and it's, if I were to die tomorrow, it would be the most important thing I've ever done.
Bob lives downstate with his wife, where he ran a restaurant business before retiring. Lil takes down an old family photo album.
Wait a minute, there's one in here in particular. That is my mother.
There are other photos of her grandparents' restaurant in Vienna, and of her father sitting at the beach in Traverse City. Lil and Bob's parents left Vienna in 1939. The Nazis had taken control of the city the year before. At the time, they only had one child, Lil and Bob's brother Steve. They left their parents and siblings behind, and Lil says it was one of the hardest moments in her mother's life.
It was heartbreaking. You know, she left her family. She couldn't do anything. She had to get out. She had no choice.
Their mother's name was Ilse. Their father was Henry. They arrived in Traverse City after they were sponsored by Congregation Beth El. Shortly after that, Lil and Bob's aunt got out of Vienna and joined them. Like their mother, their aunt, Susie, had left her parents behind. She explained that in an interview with Interlochen Public Radio almost 40 years ago.
It left me with a burden of guilt Because all of a sudden I realized that I left them. They stood there and I left them.
Vienna, 1941. Purely on the surface at that time, nothing has changed for us. We still had our fixed income, in contrast to the unfortunates who had to exist from the breadlines and donations. But inside we were just as finished as all the others. As long as there was left even a glimmer of hope to yet get out, one was able to hang on. But with the declaration of war, when all hope was lost to get to you, we were completely broken. All around us in despair, the many suicides. In this time, the poor wretches, Uncle Jacob, Giza, and Alice, jointly committed suicide.
Back in Traverse City, the family was doing everything they could to get Lil and Bob's grandparents out of Vienna. That meant getting the proper immigration paperwork, visas, sponsors, permission to leave the country. And they succeeded. But then they needed money to pay for their passage to the U.S.
Without that money, there was no chance of getting them out of Europe.
It cost about $300 per person. The family in Traverse City was struggling to make ends meet, so they had to ask other Jewish people in Traverse City for the money.
Most of the Jewish people at that point were, for lack of a better term, town burghers. They were in business. They owned their own homes. They had automobiles, and they had icebox or refrigerators full of food.
But Bob and Lil say it was hard work convincing them.
They really couldn't imagine that these people were going to go to their death if they didn't have this little bit of money.
So wait a second. There were all these people here who had money, and they didn't get it.
No, they didn't get it from anywhere.
Then their parents and aunt turned to Jewish organizations in the U.S.
And letter after letter went to different organizations appealing for the money.
But they were turned down again.
March 27th, 1942. Everything had to be done in complete secrecy. Not even our tenants must get an inkling of our plans. Finally, the day arrived when Joe Sabosky came to pick us up. At 6 p.m., we left our flat. Now with the streetcar, still with the yellow star on our persons, up to the subway, where in the station restroom we hastily ripped off the yellow stars.
2 years after Lil and Bob's parents came to Traverse City, in 1941, in the midst of World War II, the U.S. and Germany declared war. And when that happened, their grandparents could no longer legally leave Vienna and come to the United States. No amount of immigration paperwork or money would help.
At that point, our father had enough of the Jews.
Specifically Jewish people in Traverse City.
He literally said that he didn't think he could ever forgive the Jews for not being able to help or not wanting to help or trying to help. That is such a difference in his personality because he was a gentle, forgiving, intelligent person. It was drizzly, clouded over, and windy. The way was across wet fields, still soggy from snow. Our guide very nervously constantly drove us, Papa with a heavy knapsack, me with a briefcase and my purse. The anxiety, the darkness, and the horrible road, it was frightful. Suddenly I got stuck in the mud with one foot and could not go on. Joe Sabosky swore and threatened to leave us behind.
World War II ended in 1945, but there was no word from Lil and Bob's grandparents. The family in Traverse City suspected they were dead.
Finally, with everybody's help, I was able to free my foot, but the shoe stuck. By the time I was finally ready to continue, you can imagine how it was to run on with wet, muddy shoe. Then came a long stretch along the slanting train trestle, always chased, always sinking into the wet snow. And so it went for over 2 hours.
When Lil and Bob were growing up, they really didn't know anything about their grandparents and this story. They described their life in Traverse City as idyllic.
We didn't know any of this history when we were younger. What I mean is mom and dad did not sit us down and say, this is what happened to us. But you know something happened. We were still not at the border and had to hurry. But finally there we were out of the woods. Here now was the broad ribbon of a highway and across, finally Hungary. We gazed across as if it were the promised land. Now we had to be twice as careful. This was the most dangerous spot. The moon was out, and therefore that much greater danger to be discovered and perhaps get shot from both sides. Thus we had to run, one at a time, quite bent over, across the clearing as fast as we could. Joe Skoboski went first, then I, and then finally Papa, and at last we were across.
When Lil was 13 years old, she found a pamphlet. She showed it to her brothers.
It was called Never Again, and it's in three different languages. And it's actual photographs, not the photographs that you've all seen of piles of bodies. It's not that. These were photographs of actual events of torture, where they, for example, put a Jew on a seat in a circular pool to see how long it would take this person to freeze to death, and turned it.
What did you, how did you feel when you saw it?
I was devastated because I knew I was a Jew and I knew that we were Jews. And at that point in my life, I knew that we didn't come from Traverse City originally.
When it hits you when you're 12 years old that you could be walking down the street and somebody wants to kill you who doesn't even know you and has no reason to want to kill you other than the fact that you're a Jew or you're an Indian or you're black or fill in the blank. I mean, there's enough hatred to go around towards just about any ethnic group. And that more than hurt me, it bewildered me. I said, well, why the hell would anybody want to do that?
Budapest, spring 1942. Eventually, we found a furnished room, but because we could not register by ourselves, we got into the wrong hands. It cost our last money to get some papers, which actually only a regular citizen was permitted to carry. In the end, we had a very nice room with kitchen and bathroom to share, and even a balcony available. But then fate caught up with us. The man who had gotten us our papers was arrested and gave our names, and thus we were arrested on Whitsuntide, Sunday of 1942.
On that Sunday in 1942, Lil's grandparents were sent to a Hungarian prison. There, her grandmother began writing this letter that Lil's been reading. Her grandmother's name was Bella Goetz.
What's in this letter is the last communication that my mother and my aunt had with their parents.
How did the letter get to Traverse City?
It was found after the war by a cousin.
It was found when their cousin returned home. The house had been ransacked, and the only thing left was this old table, and in its drawer was the letter. It was written on toilet paper. The letter was mailed to Lil's mother and aunt in Traverse City in 1948.
Budapest, May 27th. 1943. It has now been over a year that we have been in prison, where I am now writing this. What we have gone through here and how we are able to bear it all is not so easy to describe, especially when Papa was taken elsewhere. I lost all composure and thought my heart would break. We've not specifically been able to find out where our grandparents died. We are pretty sure from some of the paperwork that we have that they were supposedly on the last train out to Auschwitz from Budapest.
Behind Lil, on the wall of her home office in Traverse City, hang pictures of her maternal and paternal grandparents.
There were 39 living siblings of those people that you see here when the war started, when the Nazis started to murder people. Of those 39, they were all married, all but one, and they had children. Now, those people are gone. I'm never going to know those people. I'm never going to know my grandparents. I don't think that you can truly ever understand what it feels like to know that there were all these people that I really would have loved to have known. I would have liked to, but I don't think there's any way that you could understand it. I never cursed anybody, but then when I was so completely separated from all those I loved and found myself in prison, I did curse all, especially those who could have helped us so easily to be there with you and did not do it. May God reckon with them. He will, and he did. All the bitter tears that we cry from our aching hearts, so far from you, our beloved ones, may they sear their hearts, and you too must never, never forgive them.
Of course, I lost my parents, so this is a personal pain, but don't you believe that for every Jew that was killed, that every Jew who has survived is hurting?
That's their aunt, Susie, again, talking to Chris Dixon at Interlochen Public Radio in 1978.
I feel that the whole world is guilty. The Germans perpetrated the things physically, but the rest of the world survived.
Their aunt says for all the people who did help Jewish people, many did not. It was easier and safer to denounce them.
The fear of self-preservation is the strongest instinct. I mean, if you have a choice of one of us is going to get killed, what are you going to do?
Well, what do you think this means about mankind? To me, it means that the potential darkness of a human being
is there.
Is incredible.
Yeah, but it is there. In the given circumstances, most people are capable of doing most things.
For Lil, this is why it's important that her family's story live on.
The genocide that this world has seen over the years, you know, Armenia and Botswana, and now with the Syrians, and in our own political dynamic in this country, we're seeing people actually talking about a whole race of people in a negative way. Have we not learned anything? But I think that that's important that you learn, as a survivor of such an atrocity, to let people know that you've survived, that your parents survived, and survived in a way where we can pass this on. And hopefully one of these days we're all going to listen to that instead of letting this happen over and over again. Dear Papa looks relatively good, and I myself look good too. But we have aged a lot. We have become very old. My hair is quite gray, and my eyes have suffered a lot. In spirit, I am with you always, and with your darlings, and by imagining them, I can bear life without you. If we only could have gotten any news from you. May God grant you a happy life and freedom. My beloved children, I shall pray for you. For your happiness in your life, I kiss and embrace you, your Muti. I'm done.
That story was produced by Morgan Springer of Interlochen Public Radio. Peter Payette was the editor. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.